All right. Thank you, Jan-Michel. Well, it's a pleasure to be here and to find the room not empty. I can look around and see who I should yell at later for having too good of a time last night. Anyhow, I'm going to tell you about our progress on developing novel non-equilibrium spectroscopy using ultrafast X-ray scattering. This is something that's evolved over, well, longer than I thought it would take to get as far as we are. But, kind of culminating in actually being able to use the LC-LS to really study, as many people here want to do, dynamics with atomic scale, spatial, and temporal resolution. So I probably don't need this slide for this audience, but I'll put it up here anyhow. And basically, what we want to do is, in some sense, the time domain version of what you heard from Peter yesterday, right? So we want to, instead of measuring S of Q and omega, we want to measure S of Q and T directly. And this is certainly important on my third bullet here if you're looking at states that are not normally accessed through equilibrium. So rare events, things with very short lifetime, possibly telling differences between inhomogeneous and homogeneous broadening, so on and so forth. Although the main reason we're doing this and investing so much time is just that the typical optical pump probe experiments, which can provide us a lot of information, just don't quite give us what we want. Okay? I also point out that working in the time domain also sometimes is really nice. It's particularly sensitive to coherence and lifetime effects, but that also can sometimes be its weakness, right? So if you don't have things wiggling around with a well-defined phase, picking out the dynamics will require doing other things like, for example, intensity-intensity autocorrelations on the excited state, more speckle-related stuff. We can't use neutrons to access this time scale, so on and so forth. Okay? All right. So to start, I think you saw this figure in Brian's talk, where if I take just some material, perfect crystal silicon, for example, in this case, shine X-rays through it, and be careful not to illuminate any Bragg peaks, then you can get these really beautiful thermal diffuse images. So this is diffuse X-ray scattering. It's telling you how the crystal behaves. It's the non-periodic part of the crystal, basically, right? So this is all the Fourier components, the junk in between the Bragg peaks. And from this type of image, if you're clever and the sample is not too complicated, you can actually back out the phonon dispersion. This was data from Martin Holt's thesis in PRL over a decade ago. The lines are the fits of the thermal diffuse scattering to the data, assuming particular model for the interatomic forces and a Bose-Einstein distribution, and the dots are what you would get from neutron scattering. So it actually, in this case, fit quite well. And I should point out that actually people were doing this kind of stuff many decades before, and as a matter of fact, before neutrons really came about to measure phonon dispersion, this was kind of what you might have to do. So early people, this was the earliest reference I could find, were looking at interatomic force constants and dispersion in simple cases. People like James Laval, so on and so forth, Warren, worked on this for a while. And then neutrons came about, kind of lost steam to do this with X-rays for the usual textbook reasons. And then, Martin's paper really, with the synchrotron, you got back at this. This is very exciting. Okay, so anyhow, so the intensity depends on a number of things, but basically, at a particular Q, what it allows you to access is actually the amplitude of motion. In this case, I write it as the occupation. And If you wanted to try and now do this to measure dynamics, of course you run into potential other problems in that if you don't know a priori what that distribution looks like, how do you do these fits? So I'm going to try and convince you that things aren't so bad. So the idea basically is shown here, we kind of want to do two types of spectroscopy that are related. One is we want to look for those populations as a function of time. So for example, to look at the anharmonic decay of a phonon into different places in the Brillouin zone. We know from energy and momentum conservation the channels that we have open to us, but we don't necessarily know the decay rates. And this, you know, has never really been observed, okay? Not the momentum resolved version of this. You can measure from neutron lifetimes. You can measure from Raman scattering lifetimes, things like that. But to follow this process hasn't been seen. Here's just a calculation of what it would look like for indium antimonide. But also, if you have excited state type dynamics, maybe you're looking at a phase transition starting to happen or just really perturbing the system far from equilibrium, we also should be able to access how the frequencies themselves change as a function of time. So as the interatomic forces change, then of course the phonon spectra would change because this is basically just the normal modes of the solid. And I show here, these are both calculations. This is for photoexcited indium antimonide driving it about to become unstable. And this is a charge density wave material cone anomaly at about where the charge density wave is going to pick up. Okay, so here's a really simple cartoon movie of what would happen ideally in the diffuse scattering if I took typical semiconductor and softened the transverse modes uniformly throughout the zone. And I'm sorry, I don't have the time scale up on this, but it's kind of a fun little psychedelic movie to watch. So what we'd like to do is basically take, you know, images like this as a function of Q and time and watch these wiggles and try and pick something out. The important thing here, though, is that you do get these wiggles. And that comes about from this sudden softening. You're basically squeezing the thermal motion of the lattice. And so if we can sit at a particular Q and measure as a function of time, then just by a Fourier transform, we can get the excited state spectrum out. So in this model, this is kind of shown here. If I start with just not quite that model, but for a Debye model, a simple linear dispersion, soften it by 20% and just show you Fourier transform at a few different peaks. Of course, you also have Debye-Waller effects to deal with. You don't just pick out what's happening at that particular mode, but it turns out in this case it's a very small contribution. I'll show you later that we actually used this model to explain the non-thermal melting of indium antimonide by not the diffuse scattering, but just looking at this Debye-Waller peak, how it changes as a function of time for if you had a sudden softening of transverse modes. And actually, I can show you that picture here. So this was data that Aaron Lindenberg et al. Took at SPPS, kind of a precursor to LCLS, our short pulses of the mid-2000s. And it shows the mean square displacement of indium antimonide excited by a laser. You can't read this here, but on the couple hundred femtosecond timescale for a couple different Bragg reflections, you had this nice linear dispersion, which could have been consistent with just snipping all the bonds and having the atoms fly apart. Eventually, they bump into their neighbors and stuff when you get mean square displacements. Actually, this is the RMS, so this is the square root of that on order of an angstrom or so. It is from time-resolved Bragg diffraction data. So we see a Bragg peak go away, and we assume that is due to a time-resolved Debye-Waller effect because the atoms are jiggling around more and more and more in the softened potential. And so if you plot then under that assumption what the mean square displacement, not the mean square displacement, the RMS displacement is as a function of time from that data. It has a linear slope, and it's actually about the room temperature, you know, root 3 kT over M, what you would expect. Hmm? 111 and 220. Okay.
Why are they different?
So they're the same in this linear region. They're different up here, and there were a couple different reasons for that. You might expect them to be different because, of course, the lattice spacing is different, and you're going to start colliding with your neighbors at a different displacement. But there might be more to it. I'd like to actually move over this, because what I'm going to try and argue is that from this data, you actually have limited information. We can't tell, for example, if you snipped all the bonds, this kind of just, you know, complete softening, no, just everything moving inertially, or if you took and completely softened the transverse acoustic modes. So as far as we know, we still have a crystal, just a very sloppy one. And we still have a bound crystal, just one that could, for example, have lost shear stability. Okay? We can't tell the difference between that with diffraction. But if you were to look in diffuse scattering, then you could actually hopefully come in and say, oh gosh, you know, this thing does go unstable at the X point or does not, you know, as theory predicts. Okay. So by example, I want to go through a problem that we've been working on for also a little more than a decade, and this is photo-excited bismuth. Bismuth, in some sense, like graphite, is a little ubiquitous, important material. If you had too much to drink last night, you might have consumed some of it in these little pink pills. But what we were interested in was exciting large amplitude coherent vibrations in this material. So the bismuth structure is a distortion of a simple cubic lattice where you kind of pull along the diagonal to make it rhombohedral, and then the atom in the center here can't decide if it wants to be closer to this guy or this guy, undergoing Pyrrhal's distortion. And so it has three nearest neighbors, three next nearest neighbors instead of sixfold. And what we do when we photo-excite is basically effectively change the equilibrium position of that ion relative to the others. And then you get this coherent oscillation at zone center, all the atoms doing this. And the pump probe optical data looks something like this. It's very beautiful. The frequency, if you measure it out here, is the frequency of this A1G phonon you'd get from Raman. If you look back here, it's actually considerably softened and chirped. There was some controversy about this for a while. We went on to show that the softened, the longer period here was actually due to electronic bond softening and not, for example, say, anharmonicity of the motion, which other people had thought, you know, that's just that you go higher in the potential well. And it's kind of easy to see why it might do that. If you change the equilibrium position of this atom, say move it more towards the symmetric position, then what you're doing basically is you're shortening these bonds and lengthening those bonds. Okay, so you might expect as you move towards having sixfold coordination that these forces are going to become much softer and you just oscillate with that. And then the chirp is due to the electron dynamics. Let me skip that. This is just how we know it's not thermal. So for the people who care about solid state here, I just show this is electronic band structure and phonon dispersion. This is neutrons for bismuth. Actually, we're running into a problem with the referee now that we have to kind of explain what that bismuth is not graphite. So I'm glad to have Peter's talk to kind of compare them with. And in particular, even though it is a semi-metal, the electrons and holes aren't in the same location in the Brillouin zone. Okay, so we actually, even in bismuth, you have these Dirac electrons. You can't really see them, but here at the L point, this is where your electrons are, and the top of the valence is actually at the T point. Okay, so this is the Brillouin zone. It's just a squished FCC. Okay, so that's along the trigonal direction, and that's perpendicular what would be the L points. Okay, and that's actually really important in how the behavior of the photoexcited carriers evolves, and that's why we're having this controversy. So what do we know so far about bismuth? Well, from X-rays, this was one of the earliest works, the one that I was involved with. We actually were able to measure the excited state potential energy surface along this A1G coordinate, so along that displacement of the atom, this Pyrrhus distortion. The red dots here are our data. The circles are just ones that we got very good time resolved information, so we could measure phonon frequency at. So this is equilibrium spacing in that double potential well as a function of the excitation of our carriers. The low temperature carrier density of bismuth is about 10 to the minus 5 or a few 10 to the minus 6. So this is very large excitation, initially very far from the Fermi surface. And the picture here is just a density functional theory calculation of what that potential energy surface would look like. So the dotted line shows how you would expect the equilibrium position to change with carrier density, and we just pick the lower well instead of the upper one. And you see that it predicts a phase transition here at a little under 3% excitation. Okay, and by the way, we can't reach without destroying the sample. So this is something that LCLS will allow us to look at on a single shot, or at least at room temperature with 1.5 volt optical pulses. We can't do that. Okay, so anyhow, so these four points here, I show a slice now in this direction measured versus the theory. Solid line is the measurement, the curvature from the frequency, and the amplitude from assuming that it was a purely displacive excitation. Okay, so we just move the equilibrium position, set our classical marble rolling down the well and back. And dotted line is the theory, including all orders of the anharmonicity, and you can see actually that our experiment, which assumes harmonic, agrees even up to these very high densities. The density functional perturbation theory calculations of the phonon dispersion at actually this 1% point, sorry, the contrast isn't so good there, looks something like this. But what we see is that the expectation is that all of the optical modes and to a lesser extent, the acoustic modes are softened with this excitation, and the softening is actually the most at zone center. What we've measured so far, both optically and with X-rays, is just this single zone center mode going to that mode. Okay, so just this to that. And we've measured the decay rate, but not the decay product. So we want to, again, go back and really experimentally be able to determine these curves and how things move about. I should point out, by the way, that if indeed we're exciting this high of an amplitude, the amount of energy stored in this mode is actually non-negligible. It's a decent fraction of KT. You can see here it's about 5 millivolts or so. Of course, in the electronic degrees of freedom, we have much higher than that. So we also want to see how the electrons decay. Now, Steve Johnson did a very important experiment recently where, looking carefully at diffraction, he also followed how the Dwi-Waller factor changes, and he showed some evidence that he could actually see this squeezing in the Dwi-Waller factor. But again, the problem with these type experiments is that you really limit yourself to a sum over all the modes, and so he can basically see, we think, actually this bit here, the softening of the primarily the acoustic modes, okay? And in the density of states. This is the same type thing you would see, for example, if you did second order Raman scattering. Okay. So we're getting a lot of information, but we're not quite there. I think I will skip over this. This is just what we know about the carrier dynamics. If someone wants to ask me about the problems we're having with referees on that, I'll be glad to talk about it. So there are some still outstanding questions. The first, of course, is that we would like to measure that excited state potential, compare it with theory, really find out how the forces evolve as a function of time after photo excitation, clearly not just for bismuth, but you know, can we drive this transient high symmetry state that would be metallic? What are the anharmonic decay channels and rates? Can we follow the electron and hole distributions and see how they thermalize with the lattice and how they recombine? That's the slide I skipped over. Also, I didn't put in this talk, but we've done a lot of work on Raman scattering and comparing that with both the time resolved and frequency resolved versions of it. And it turns out you actually, despite what some of you may have heard in the past, there is actually a difference between pump probe and spontaneous Raman in the solid. And in particular, we've shown that the EG mode, which is instead of this fully symmetric mode, the transverse optical mode, the coherence is actually really fragile in bismuth with temperature, much less fragile in a related material, antimony, with temperature, and we'd kind of like to understand that. So we have five LCLS shifts to do all this coming up in November in Dave Fritz's beam time. So I don't know. We can either count how many PRLs there or hope that we can do at least one of those and that it's accepted. Okay, so we went off to the APS to try and get an idea of how much flux we need to make some of these measurements. This was actually done on the BioCars beamline, sector 14, where you can get somewhere on order of 10 to the 10 hard X-ray photons per pulse, relatively broad bandwidth in about 100 picoseconds. Doesn't come across very good here, but this is the thermal diffuse scattering from bismuth. Doesn't look as good as the silicon. These bright spots here are truncation rods due to this really high surface sensitivity because we come in at grazing incidence to match the laser. What I show here is actually now really high fluence data where we come in and just blast the sample, and turns out we watch it melt, and in this case, epitaxially regrow. Good news is that so this is this liquid ring coming and going, that we could see that, and we could see it with good signal to noise. These are just averages of five shots, and the fact that we can average five shots survives that long. But to really look at what's going on, you know, in these intermediate densities, we have a couple of problems. One is enough flux, and the other is the time resolution is lacking. So what we did is we then went and looked at another system that we've been interested in, which is polar semiconductors. Everything we do is with, you know, kind of 20th century materials. In this case, I'm showing you, so this is the thermal diffuse scattering pattern of indium phosphide. So this is just a zinc blend binary semiconductor. And then I show you progression I didn't put the times on here. You'll see it on another slide. This is, I think, 100 picoseconds, 200, 400, and a few nanoseconds after laser excitation, showing you the difference between the excited images and the thermal diffuse pattern. And C is just a simple calculation that you might do if you were trying to fit the data as Martin Holt did. But of course, we can't fit to these because we don't know what those distributions are. But we do know something funny is going on. So you can actually see it. It's kind of hard, but if you look closely, especially in here at the maybe this was 400 picoseconds and this is about a nanosecond, in between these very bright areas where you are dominated by longitudinal acoustic near zone center, there is some differences going on between these images. It's much easier to see if we start playing with the data. So here are normalized differences between 400 picoseconds and 100 picoseconds for indium phosphide and indium antimonide. Red means that the phonons are continuing to populate. Blue means that they're depopulating. And in both cases, you can see we still have something non-equilibrium going on. Much richer picture for the indium phosphide, which may be due to the fact that, you know, the difference in mass between indium and phosphorus is so large that there's this huge gap between the acoustic and optical, phonons. So even kinematically, there's very little place for the phonons to decay by three-body decay, whereas in indium antimonide, the picture is completely different. There's almost no gap. So we struggled with that for a while, and people kept telling us, why don't you, you know, do what chemists and biologists and other people do and just do, you know, singular value decomposition on these images and let the computer tell you what's important with all the proper caveats. And it turned out in this case, it actually did give us some interesting information. So we took those images, single line in MATLAB, give us the principal values and the principal, whatever you call them, vectors, and singular vectors.
David?
Yes, sir?
Can you say what it is that you apply the singular value
to? Oh, so so we take all the pixels at all the times, okay? So we make a big matrix of pixels as a function of time, okay? And that's about all I can say about it, because the rest of MATLAB just does, and turns out it gave us something that may or may not be meaningful. But anyhow, so what we do, so it turns out that of the, you know, however many hundreds of thousands of pixels we kept in here, there were basically two vectors that were important. This is for indium phosphide. It's A, something that kind of looks like the thermal diffuse pattern, and B, something that I'll describe in a minute why it may look like that. And so to get your images, basically you take the singular value at a function of time multiplied by this plus, you know, this times that, and the rest was just noise. And then for indium antimonide, we get similar things. So you see here, this is in nanoseconds, you get a very fast rise and the thing that kind of looks like the thermal diffuse, a slow decay, whereas this one that includes some things going up, other things going down, you get this rapid drop and then a delay of an order hundreds of picoseconds to nanoseconds before it peaks. And that's common for both of these. Okay, so what might that be? Well, I'm just blowing up some region in these pictures. Just pick a little section in here. And since we can fit to a reasonable function of the equilibrium forces, we're able to separate the contribution to the diffuse scattering from longitudinal acoustic and transverse acoustic modes, for example. And I plot this as contours here in A and C with the second singular vector, I don't even know if I'm using the right terminology there, on top of it. And you can see that in the case of indium phosphide, that there's a very strong correlation here in these red areas with a transverse acoustic, and the blue areas here with the longitudinal acoustic. And here it is without the contours. Each one of these little funny distorted hexagons here are just showing you different Brillouin zones that we sample. And then similar results, a little more complicated in the case of indium antimonide. So we're starting to get an understanding of this. It was somewhat surprising that on this couple hundred picosecond to nanosecond time scale that we had anything other than heat. We get mostly heat. If I go back to this, you can see that these singular values are about a factor of 10 higher, but we have, you know, 10% of something really funny going on. Starting to get an idea what's happening, but again, you know, this is on very long time scale. It's very far after the initial excitation and first decay products that we want to look at, but nonetheless, it's pretty remarkable. Also goes to show that we can easily get enough signal to noise on something like LCLS with the shorter, brighter pulses. Okay, so in summary, I hope I've convinced you that time-resolved X-ray scattering can be a powerful tool for studying transient non-equilibrium dynamics. We concentrated here on information you can get from diffuse scattering from single crystals and non-resonant case at that. We've made some progress in our understanding of the excited state of bismuth, but every time I think I understand this prototypical material that was just supposed to be, you know, getting my foot in the door, interesting things come up. Similarly, in the photo-excited polar semiconductors, we get some long-lived non-equilibrium dynamics at times where you would expect that the lattice would just have been thermalized. We require short pulses and access to beam time to go much further. And didn't talk about it, but much of the discussion could be applicable to electronic processes, a little more challenging, but something to think about. Okay, so I guess with that, let me just quickly go through the acknowledgments. Mariano Trigo is a postdoc, did most of the diffuse scattering work. Jan Chen is a student. He's been working primarily on understanding the Raman experiments. Shimbu and Vinayak have other projects, but have been helping out a lot. Yuman Xu just recently moved to Tony Taylor's group at Los Alamos, has done the electronic part. Tim Graber and Robert Henning have helped us immensely, great collaborators to have on the BioCars beamline. And there's a large number of people who have helped in the past, including, I should point out, Dave Fritz, who's instrument scientist at LCLS, so the SPPS data was really his. Adrian Cavallari, who's now at CFEL, did the pulse-to-pulse timing, which I didn't talk about at all, that allowed us to even do that experiment, and many others, Eamon Murray, Stephen Fahey for theory support, and of course, SPPS collaboration. Okay, so with that, I thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, David, for the nice talk. The paper's open in discussions, please.
Can you comment on what you might expect to see with the LCLS because the beam will be coherent, the X-ray beam? These are beautiful results from the synchrotron looking at, you know, diffuse scattering, and presumably you're going to start seeing speckle in all of this, but you're exciting it sort of more or less coherently. Do you think it's a coherent enough excitation you'll see actual, you know, at the moment it just looks like thermal populations moving around. Do you expect to see that when you actually resolve the speckle?
Well, what I hope to see, even irrespective of the speckle, is not thermal populations going around, but actually oscillation, kind of a coherent oscillation, because I've really squeezed the lattice.
Okay.
Now, that's just a complete incoherent X-ray result. Whether or not we can gain additional information from speckle, this is something that I do think is possible. The first experiments, I don't think, will be terribly sensitive to it because we'll have a very large spot.
You won't really be resolving this speckle.
Except for the, you know, very, you know, extended stuff across the sample, which I don't think will be a big problem, but we'll see. certainly the first order business is that we're just going to do a lot of averaging. But from there, I think, yeah, there's a lot of potential that bringing speckle into this, we can do good stuff. In particular, you know, this comment that I made that having to look at coherent processes, having to look at the wiggles, we can maybe get beyond that. We can excite, you know, photo excite, and then look at the incoherent processes by kind of the two-pulse speckle that, that you're working on.
So I can imagine there's could be a lot of theoretical development and understanding Q, you know, different correlation functions. You're going to get some interesting correlations at different Qs and different times with that kind of exercise.
That's right, definitely. That's an invitation.
More questions? So I'm wondering what is, oh, there's, okay, but I'm wondering where's actually the transition, or can you make that between coherent and incoherent for these systems time-wise? I mean, how long does it stay coherent, and could you really see that somehow, how it decoheres? That would be very interesting.
Yeah,
what
so,
does one have to look at?
Well, so of course, you know, the first answer to that is we need good enough temporal resolution to observe this, and I think that and we need excitations that are sufficiently brief that assumption is good. But so assuming that both those conditions are made, I don't see any reason why you can't, you know, watch this, you know, kind of squeeze mode bounce around back and forth, decohere, and make it into the excited state where it is a presumably, if not a thermal population, at least an athermal population that's more or less staying put incoherently.
I have two questions. Actually, the first would relate to that data you've shown, I think was melting of bismuth with this liquid ring that was synchrotron data. The liquid ring was already visible in the first spot because in the first time point. But then that went away. Was that? And you said, yeah. That's why is the epitaxial regrowth? Why doesn't that show anything in the lower line?
What is that? Because again, I didn't tell you, but these are difference measurements.
Oh. Okay.
So if it's a blank image, it's what it started.
Okay. Thank you. And the second question was the first data you were showing before you talked about the synchrotron, was that a lab source, a plasma source?
It was all optical.
It was all optical.
Yeah, so it was just a Thai sapphire split into pump probe.
Yeah. At some point, it said diffraction, though. X-ray diffraction, Fritz et al. And
Sorry. No, that one was this one?
Yeah.
Or are you talking about?
Yeah.
So this
one
was X-rays. This was at SPPS, which was a parasitic operation at SLAC with compressed electron spontaneous. The experiment, this one was the all-optical one.
Yeah.
Both of them were Fritz.
So there was no femtosecond laser plasma-generated X-rays involved in this?
No. There was a prior experiment by Klaus Sokolowski-Tintin et al. That looked at this, and they saw kind of extreme softening and stuff, and that was actually, I think, 2001, 2002, something like that. Very nice heroic work there, too.
So David, can you go back to your outstanding question slide, please?
I put those up late at night, so that's danger, right?
Well, so I mean, for example, the first point says an outstanding question is the experimental determination of the excited state potential, and so I guess my question is:
are you worried that it doesn't have a question mark on it? What is the?
Well, no, I mean, my question is basically among these 5 points listed. What is a theoretical challenge, and what is, in a sense, simply an experimental challenge, something that people in principle expect to see, but simply hasn't been difficult to see so far?
So the experimental challenge, in one regard, is getting theorists to agree of what constraints they put into their density functional theory. So Stephen Fahey has looked a little bit into this, and actually the data that we're fighting with the referee over with seems to point that it might be appropriate to consider the electrons and holes independently and have, you know, two different chemical potentials and then just fill your states that way. Martin Garcia's group has been arguing that it's more appropriate to treat it more like a metal and have a, you know, single chemical potential, and the temperature defines the carriers. But of course, we know that neither of those is very close to reality. We have this, you know, hugely hot plasma that we're generating. We're putting carriers all over the place. So I would say, you know, the theoretical problem is just, you know, where do you start? I mean, moving past that, and you know, where do you put the electrons? You know, how do you do the proper constraints and the calculations? I don't know. Is that what you're after? Or?
Yeah, I'm curious in kind of where the theoretical challenges lie, and
I mean, calculating. I mean, all these calculations were density functional perturbation theory or frozen phonon.
Right. So that is a question in a sense. This is really a question for me. I don't know. I mean, regular DFT, at least in strict sense, is a ground state theory, and only for that ground state, I think.
That's right.
Does any rigorous statement exist? And I wonder whether for these plasmas, whether there's are any rigorous statements for formulations of DFT that would allow one to do something that's at least conceptually meaningful.
So I think rigorous, I don't want to say but that I know the answer, but I suspect it's no. you know, something meaningful, I think, you know, if you have a reasonable constraint that you put in there, hopefully you'll get reasonable results that at least help guide the experiments out. But that's pretty much all I can say about it. I mean, everything so far has been really kind of simplistic. So, but hard work. I don't want to denigrate what it takes to do these calculations.
I had two questions. One is, have you given any thought to creating non-equilibrium populations away from Q equals zero through specific excitation mechanisms?
Yeah.
And the second, in your APS experiment, are you sensitive to propagation effects, phonons propagating out of your X-ray probing volume?
So the short answer to both of those is yes. I mean, we would love to be able to go in and excite a single mode anywhere in the zone and then watch how that decays. That was kind of, I guess, would in some sense be the holy grail of that type of spectroscopy. With regards to propagation effects, and I don't really know how to do that, but we have some ideas on at least how to make one area more important than others. But as far as on the propagation effects, I think ballistically, the contribution is very small. That would kind of occur over the 100 picosecond time scale. So what we're really seeing is diffusive type propagation. And I think that's what the slow decay is just the sample cooling.
Okay, if there are no more questions, I have a final one, which is probably almost forbidden regarding LCLS, but I'm wondering, what do we really need LCLS for in your context? Because it seems to me what you need is more intensity, that's clear. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have more signal. On the other hand, it's very probable that this will destroy what you want to observe, at least for your stuff with phonons and so on, right? So what is actually the really physical questions you are after?
So,
if you do not have LCLS, I mean.
Well, the problem if we don't have LCLS is getting enough flux to see these things happen, especially as we excite with the laser harder and harder, and it might not be reproducible. So I don't think there's any other way than with an FEL to do that. With regards to whether or not we're damaging the sample with the X-ray FEL, at least these type experiments are all done on single crystals with a rather elongated pulse, and we can reduce the intensity and average for a while. That's fine. But on the other hand, we can also, I mean, the pulse is so brief that, you know, what's happening on the front of the pulse may not substantially affect what's happening on the tail. At least, you know, we got a lot of electrons to look at in bismuth. It should be okay, I hope.
Okay, maybe on this note, we close the talk. Thank David again. And come to the second morning talk by Wilfried Wurth from the University of Hamburg. And he will be talking on ultrafast dynamics in solids probed and induced by soft X-ray.